This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. On September 2nd, 2013, 64-year-old Diana Nyad staggered out of the water at Key West, Florida, after swimming 110.86 miles for 52 hours, 54 minutes, and 18 seconds, beginning in Cuba. It was a historic swim and a singular achievement for Nyad, who had tried and failed to complete it four times before. She had to abandon those swims because of burning and toxic jellyfish stings, strong currents, and rough waters that took a toll on her body. Diana Nyad is an open water, a long-distance swimmer who broke records when she was much younger, the fastest to swim around Manhattan and breaking the distance record from the Bahamas to Florida. She writes about all of this in her new memoir, and it's titled Find a Way. It's also about the sexual abuse she endured as a young girl by her stepfather and her swimming coach, and how swimming helped her cope with the loneliness, the confusion, and feeling like, as she says, an injured little girl. Diana Nyad joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, the pleasure is all mine.
I did post the video of you climbing out of the waters in Key West, and I looked at it several times. You don't even look like you know where you are.
No, I did. You know, clearly, I was both physically and emotionally, under duress, clearly. But the overwhelming relief and the overwhelming pride that my team and I took, not of making it, of not giving up on it. I was filled with that day. Now, I admit that I don't remember any of those words I said on the beach. I've seen that film just about daily as I speak to groups. So the first words were never, ever give up. And honestly, all those people on that beach, there were several thousand there, the millions who have written in, they weren't swimming fans, sports fans. They're people who on their own dreams, on their own obstacles, know that if they just don't give up, they'll get there. So that was the message. And honestly, through the years, I had gone through, just when you're bored out there swimming, gone through the oration I would give on the beach when I finally made it, but it didn't happen that way. Just something automatic came out.
You had done this or tried this four times before. Was there a point at which you said to yourself, I'm going to make it this time?
Every time. I mean, you don't ever, you don't stand at the base of Everest and say, well, I probably won't make it up this time. You have all the grit, all the intelligence, all the group prepared, and you're shocked when the weather comes in or, you know, someone is dying of altitude sickness or, God forbid, someone falls off the edge of the mountain. And here, every time we stood on the shore of Cuba, I was more brash and cocky when I was 28 and tried it. I was like, jellyfish, sharks, get out of my way. Here I come. And I was humbled quickly. But all four times you stand there and say, there has been no stone unturned. We're going all the way across. And you're crushed when it doesn't work out.
You were 64 at the time, and I do want to talk about your body as a 64-year-old and your swimming body as a 20-year-old, but also it seemed as if the currents, perhaps the weather, things cooperated some more this time?
Yes and no. The current, yes. The weather, no. That first night, we had a whipping wind. There were many people on boat on the successful swim in 2013. Many people on our boats were seasick. We were bouncing around pretty well. I was wearing a silicone mask to protect from those deadly box jellyfish stings, because, by the way, the highly scientific pantyhose hadn't worked out that well the year before. So this was a prosthetic sort of mask allowed in the sport. I mean, you could say allowed. No one's ever used one, but these are deadly animals. You're allowed to go to certain degrees in terms of saving life, you know, life or death circumstances, and that box jellyfish is almost always fatal. I should have died in 2011. Should have. Didn't. I think on will alone, honestly, Marty, I think it was will that allowed me to get through that. But that first night, there was a whipping wind, and I was slapped in the face with the water. You can't feel your face and your mouth as well with that mask on, so I couldn't judge when to take a sip of oxygen. And I was vomiting in that mask all night. Difficult. Now your tensile strength is weak, and your fingers are numb, so to feel, to try to get the edge of that mask on the throat and pull it up and clean it out, that was a hell of a night. So I wouldn't have called it beautiful, perfect weather.
Right.
We actually had better, smooth seas on other attempts. But that's the whole point that you're bringing up. There is a there is a cataclysm of obstacles out there. It is the most difficult swim in the world. It's been called the Mount Everest of the worst world's oceans. People since 1950, strong men and women had tried across, and most people put the chances of this swim, after I failed four times, at zero. No one's ever going to make it.
And you did. You describe in pretty vivid detail about what it's like to get stung by a box jellyfish. And as you said, it can be fatal. It's just and just the sort of screaming hotness of the sting, right?
Yeah, and you feel the paralysis of your spinal cord. What happens is this animal is 600 million years old. Its venom has been developed to perfection. And when it touches animal protein, a seahorse, a turtle, a fish, or a human being, it instantaneously, through its tentacles, fires that venom into your central nervous system. You feel the spinal cord paralyzing. You feel your breath. I went down to 3 breaths a minute. You ask any physician, you're not going to live long at that. And I was screaming out to Bonnie on the boat, Bonnie, help me. I'm on fire. Help me. Help me. And I honestly think the doctors on board didn't know what the heck. They're versed in emergency room medicine, in endurance sports medicine, but not the box jellyfish. So after that swim, we got with Dr. Angel Yanagihara, the world's leading box jellyfish expert, and she educated us for the next time around.
And were they everywhere? I mean, did you have to sort of navigate between box
there's
jellyfish?
There's no navigating. I mean, they are everywhere. When they swarm, and there are different, you know, levels, we could do an entire hour just on these little creatures. They're and actually, people think I hate them. I actually revere them. I can't believe how
survival,
potent.
Right?
It's the most potent venom on Earth. There's no snake that has this venom.
Yeah. There are photographs in your book, and it looks like almost like lashes on your arms, on your shoulder, your parts of your body where what they have touched you.
That's the whip of the tentacle, so it wraps around. You know, like any tentacle, it wraps around, and just if you picture from the edge of your wrist up to the edge of your elbow, just your forearm, a tentacle just that length of the box has on it 300,000 harpoons. And you can see them. Once you get out of the water and you look at that red stripe, you look at the tiny little points, 300,000, and every one of those is firing its venom into your central nervous system.
Well, as you said, we could do a whole hour on the box jellyfish.
We could.
But so what, in a nutshell, what was the, if not antidote, I mean, how were you able to then swim through them the last time around?
You know, I think that Angel, number one, taught me that I was going to have armor. I was going to have to be covered. You're not allowed neoprene in this sport because it's a flotation device. You're not allowed a warming type of suit because you have to take the elements. But you are allowed what they call a stinger suit. It's very, very thin, and its fabric doesn't allow the tentacles to penetrate. They can't. Wow. Those harpoons can't get through it. I wore surgeon's gloves. They're difficult to swim in. You can't wait till the morning. You only wear this during the night. They come up at night, and then they dive back down at dawn. So these surgeon gloves, very tiring on the hands, little Lycra booties. Again, a swimmer likes to be free. When the dawn would come and I could take all the stuff off, I was just so happy. But but Angel taught us, and she developed something. I mean, you know, it's called Sting No More, because these animals are proliferating because of global warming, all over the world, Thailand, Israel, they're everywhere now. They're going to affect Florida's beaches, and they are deadly. So she's developing a salve called Sting No More. I couldn't use it because I couldn't put it on every square inch of the body and have it stay there.
Right.
But it did help. It mitigated. I was stung in 2013, and I quickly came to the side of the boat. You're never allowed to touch the boat. You can't get out. But she and Bonnie, my head handler, could reach over and smear my lips or whatever I had been stung with that Sting No More. And I was stung, but not debilitated.
Certainly the physical aspects of swimming 110.86 miles in 52 hours and some change, that's one thing. But there's also the sort of mental toughness that you have. And you have a really interesting way of dealing with that, which is a playlist that you have rattling around in your head, or maybe not. I mean, it seems like it's almost like you can push a button and listen to a certain kind of song.
Yeah,
it's push a button in your head. Obviously.
Yeah. It's not rattling so much. It's very disciplined. You know, first of all, you have this metronomic stroke, so it not only are you trying to pass the time. I can literally count the time. So if I take a song, Janis Joplin's "Me and Bobby McGee," the Beatles' "Ticket to Ride," Dylan, all those songs of my era or what filled my brain. I had a playlist of 85 songs, plus a lot of counting and logarithms. And those songs mean something to you, like in the middle of the night. Sometimes, Marty, you're in a state of sensory deprivation. Your eyes are covered. Your ears are covered. You are in your own little world. You're out with Stephen Hawking and the majesty of the universe. You don't know what the heck. You've forgotten, all about reality at this point. So to keep in it, to keep focused, to keep as close to reality as possible, I would sing, for instance, especially at 2, 3, 4 in the morning, you don't believe the sun is ever going to come up again. You think that we live in perpetual darkness. And I would pick especially Neil Young. That falsetto voice was magic. It would go wafting through my brain. And I know his songs. I know "The Needle and the Damage Done." I know it from the first note to the last note, and I know the measures 4/4 time. And when I finish singing 1,000 needle, literally, 1,000 "Needle in the Damage Done," I am at 11 hours and 7 minutes. That's how long it takes, and I don't lose count, and I sing them all the way through. So it's a discipline, get me engaged in something.
Well, we happen to have "The Needle and the Damage Done" queued up for you. I don't want to send you back on this swimming.
You don't.
But let's just give it a listen just so that our listeners can hear what was going on in Diana Nyad's head, especially in the middle of the night swimming from Cuba to Florida.
Cool.
Knocking at my cellar door. I love you, baby. Can I have some more? Ooh, the damage done. I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man.
Neil Young's "The Needle and the Damage Done" from his 72 album Harvest, and this is the song, Diana Nyad, that you would sing to yourself in the middle of the night.
I just went through chills hearing that, and so you picture me out there, we've just heard his brilliant voice, but you picture me, left arm right now, I caught you knocking at my cellar door, and I'm in it. I'm in that song, and 11 hours later, it's helped me get through those hours and stay kind of close to who am I and what I'm doing.
Are you singing out loud or singing in
your head? No, I'm not. I can't waste that kind of energy.
I was going to say.
The fish would swim away.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Diana Nyad, open water, long-distance swimmer. She's broken a number of records and swam just a couple of years ago in 2013 from Cuba to the Key West, Key West, Florida, 52 hours and some change, 110.86 miles. Much more after this very short break, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Diana Nyad about her swimming adventure, if I can put it that way, swimming a couple of years from Cuba to the Key West, Florida. She did this. This was her fifth try, a successful try, a historic swim, and it's something that she writes about in her new book, a memoir titled Find a Way. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Diana, you were describing, I guess, the sort of being out in the middle of the water between Cuba and Florida and the kind of silence, feeling like you're there with Stephen Hawking and the universe.
Yeah.
Are you also hearing your breath when you're swimming? Are you
very
aware?
Much.
And is that important to you?
You know, it's not important. It's just that it's dramatic. You know, people look and it looks like silence. You know, whenever you see the film of a swimmer going across the ocean, it looks like a balletic, quiet, a little slithering. But when your ears are underwater, you're hearing almost like, you know, you're listening to a sonogram of a baby's breath. You're hearing every breath is going... It's echoing underwater, so there's a big noise underwater for me all the time. It's not important. Yeah. It's not distracting. It just is.
What stroke do you use, or do you use all?
Oh, freestyle. You're trying to go as, believe it or not, you're not sprinting by any means, but you are going north against a due east current. Picture the Gulf Stream has just come out of the Yucatan Channel, and it is screeching four or five times your speed to the east toward the Bahamas before it heads north up the Atlantic coast. And you are trying to go due north toward the Keys. Wow. Any little bit you go east, and you're going to, because that stream is stronger than you are. I had a genius of a mathematical navigator who, you know, plotted it all out, literally every 15 minutes, changing the course against the current, my speed, the tides. And so you are trying to plummet yourself north. You're northing all the time. And anytime you got to come in, as you do, toward the boat to grab some water, some electrolytes, some, you know, you're sick to your stomach. You're in a crisis. You're in hallucinations, which you are. Bonnie's trying to talk me back into reality. Every time you stop and tread water, as I said, you can't touch the boat, but you tread water next to the boat. You're going east, 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 east. And then that 100-mile distance, which is undeniably long to start with. No one's ever gone close to that before. Now you're out to the east, and that track toward Key West is now 120 miles, 130 miles, 140 miles. So you do not want to do breaststroke or anything slow. You want to north as powerfully as you can.
I can imagine, and I know some of your other swims, you've lost, you know, 20, 30 pounds. Did you lose a lot of weight? And I just can't imagine that you can eat enough.
What, you can't.
Through a straw however, in order to maintain your weight.
You're losing all the time. You know, Bonnie tried to keep me on a 700 calorie an hour. So you just picture that for let's multiply that out for 24 hours. That's a lot of calories.
I can't do math that quickly.
But it's a lot of calories during the day. And even at that, first of all, you can't keep that up. You start feeling ill. You know, anybody, you talk to people at high altitude or running across the Kalahari Desert in heat, the extreme endurance athletes, they call it the iron stomach. We all have will. We have iron will. We all have bodies that have gotten in the right kind of shape, endurance. We have gifts as endurance athletes. But can the stomach, once you've put that, once you're under that kind of duress, can you still take in? Toward the end of this swim, Bonnie would beg me to take an ounce of some kind of liquid, an ounce, just to keep the hydration up. And I don't want to. I'm upset.
You're just filled up, or you're
no,
just...
No, you're upset. No, you're not full. Right. You're upset. Your system is under hardship. And you don't, just like when you, if you feel ill, the last thing you want to do is eat. So you don't want to take anything in. And it's the balance. Right. Honestly, when I walked up on that beach, I think you used the word in the beginning, staggered, which is the right...
Yeah, I did.
I'm not sure if I had another hour in me. I'm not sure. You know, but it's a lot because of the stomach. Can't take anything more.
You have described this, and I don't know how strongly you mean it, but that it, or perhaps it has been described as a masochistic sport. And as you describe how difficult it is and the kind of taxing effects on the body, it, to an outsider, that feels like pain and discomfort and something masochistic.
You know, again, to bring in all the other extreme adventurers, if you talk to anybody who's climbed Annapurna, K2, you know, they will tell you that there is a lot of suffering. Yeah. Just nobody goes up and says, oh, my God, we had the greatest time. You know, it doesn't happen that way.
No, can't imagine.
On the other hand, Ed Vischiers is a friend of mine who's climbed Mount Everest more than anyone, the pure way, without bottled oxygen. As much as he has suffered on every trip up those big mountains, he has felt joy and awe. He stood on the couloirs of Everest and looked across, being the only person above the rest of the world, and seeing this magnificent planet of ours. I have, at times when I'm in shape, before you know, I'm struggling in the early months, once I'm in shape, swimming from island to island in the Caribbean, almost having the sensation of swimming over the curvature of the earth, traveling. People would stop us and say, do you guys want to ride? Are you going over to Anguilla? We said, said, oh, no, we're swimming there. They said, you're not. You're not swimming all the way there. So there's joy, there's awe at this blue jewel of a planet. Looking up at 7 billion stars at night is, I say Stephen Hawking, I mean it. Yeah. I read Stephen Hawking the night before the big swims and think about, you know, he says in A Brief History of Time, most astrophysicists today believe that at the precipice of the Big Bang, all of this matter and energy that we all know about in the universe used to exist literally in the size of a millionth of a penny. What are you talking about? Right. You put that book down and just read that one sentence. Well, you feel that exponentially when you're out there on your own speed and look up and say, all of this existed, you know, the macro numbers. Oh, it's billion light years away. It would take us 50 years to read. Well, the nano numbers are just as shocking. So I'm into all that stuff, lay astrophysics, and it's awe-inspiring to be out there and thinking about all that.
Well, from poetry to prose, what do you do about going to the bathroom?
You know, kids love that. When I speak to kids, they all start tittering, you know, and they punch each other because they know the question they want to ask. I'm afraid you just let it fly,
right.
You know.
But you can, right? I mean, that's a good thing, right?
I do believe that I raised the water table, you know, from the amount of urine that I put into it. I'm afraid to say during that 52 hours, yeah.
Well, someone did the math for us, 16,800 calories. That would be per day. That's mm-hmm. how much you were consuming, which explains why you might have raised the urine level.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but as I say, you can't take in what you're putting out. There's a brilliant sports scientist from University of Cape Town in South Africa named Timothy Noakes, and he helped our team tremendously. He's basically a nutritionist, but he taught Bonnie not to just give me compressed goos and gels, which are terrific for a marathon runner, something short right. of that distance, with all due respect. But when you're out there this long, first of all, you're immersed in a liquid 20 degrees colder than your body temperature. So your metabolic rate is going down and down and down. You are digesting in the supine position, which means a lot of that nutrition doesn't go into your digestive system for your contraction, your muscles. It goes into what they call empty spaces. So he taught us to eat real food. I'd come over to the side of the boat. Bonnie would take big handfuls of plain cooked pasta. I'd open my mouth. Like a SeaWorld
right.
sort of.
I can see it.
That's going to be my next job probably. and drop, you know, pasta into the mouth to try to get something to coat the stomach more and something more digestible than these little goos and things. But you're taking all this in, and I must say that right before the fifth attempt, Tim Noakes, who had helped us very much, wrote me kind of a Dear John letter.
Oh.
He said, Diana, I admire you're valiant. You're going to try it again. You know, we all admire your tenacity, but I'm telling you, this swim, I've got right here, I have the glycogen deprivation mathematics right here for you. Forget about the elements, the sharks and the jellyfish and the wind and the currents and the bad weather that comes up suddenly. Just the body cannot be immersed in this particular liquid for this amount of time. You can't keep up with what you can't take in what you're putting out. You'll run out of fuel. You can't do it. Wow. And I wrote back and said, Tim, I respect you so much. We've learned so much from you, but you're forgetting the critical element in this, which is you can do me the computations of the glycogen deprivation all day. I appreciate it. What's the computation of the power of the human spirit? We have no idea, and don't tell me the limitation of that. And frankly, that is the key right there. You have to be smart. You got to be well trained. You got to have the right nutrition. You got to have the shark experts. My team is crucial to me. It's all about, in the end, the power of the human spirit.
Did he know that he was dealing with Diana Nyad, who doesn't seem like she says no to certainly this?
Well, he's I saw him in South Africa last December, a year ago, and he said, I've never been so happy to be wrong in my life.
And that is Diana Nyad, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She is a long-distance swimmer, an endurance swimmer, and she swam from Cuba to Key West, Florida, more than 100 miles, and writes about it in her new book, a memoir called Find a Way. It's also about other parts of her life, growing up in Florida, becoming the swimmer that she is. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You do have a piece in here about your body. You were 64 at the time. You say, physically, I am a better endurance athlete in my 60s than I was in my 20s. I was faster back then, but in this era, I have more brute strength. I was somewhat of a thoroughbred in my youth. I'm now a sturdy Clydesdale. You don't look like a sturdy Clydesdale.
No, I was slighter. I was more slender, you know, in that time. And I do believe now it wouldn't be right, probably. Let's pick, you know, football. Look at Peyton Manning. You know, they talk about him as a decrepit old man at 39. And in that sport, with those types of collisions, you probably at 64, you won't be making it in the NFL. I don't want to put that limit on anybody, but probably. John McEnroe, you know, is playing in the Masters Tennis Tour. Now, I don't know how old John is, but I'm thinking late 50s, 60s, sort of.
Like that.
And, you know, he wouldn't play Djokovic today. He wouldn't play him well. But in something like an extreme endurance activity, where your VO2 max, which is a measurement of the oxygen you can use, your lung capacity, I frankly am superior at a lot of those physiological traits that it takes to be a great endurance athlete, not even to mention the mental side, which is almost all of it. So, you know, who's to tell me in my 60s that I couldn't, you know, repeat or even be better than I was, especially with the mental and the emotional, being more mature, being, you know, this time I was in love with the ocean. This time I was grateful for the opportunity to live this extreme dream, whereas in my 20s I was more ego-driven and angry about things and, you know, kind of immature. So I was better. I am better. I sit before you today at 66. I am telling you, I feel in better shape as an all-round athlete. Now, I might not say that at 96, but at 66, I'm still better than I was in my mid-20s.
In fact, you say in this paragraph that you bounce back from muscle and tendon strains and injuries. And I think a lot of people at your, and frankly my age, it feels like bouncing back is really hard and takes much too long.
You know, I do hear that. People my age often say that's the one thing I can't recover. If I do a tough thing, a tough workout, then I'm hurting. But you have to be holistic about it. I've always stretched the body, and I believe in the power of the mind. And I guess I can't think of a day, maybe one or two flus through the years. I can't think of a day since I was 5. So I'm 66 now. Yeah. That's my entire life that I haven't been in supreme physical shape. So that bouncing back, you know, is happening. Mm-hmm. Now, I do say I am slower, both as a runner, you know, a walker, a swimmer than I was in my 20s. I don't have as much quick speed off the mark, but I guess I don't need that much
anymore. Apparently you don't. You grew up in Florida.
Yeah.
And Florida, of course, a place where you can swim.
Yeah.
So were you an early swimmer?
Yeah, I was. You know, as a matter of fact, on my 5th birthday, I wasn't a swimmer. My father was a charismatic histrionic guy, so Greek Egyptian Aristotle Zenith Naiad, and he was just a living drama, tears welling up in his eyes at all times. On my 5th birthday, he calls me into the den. He's got Webster's big unabridged dictionary open with his hands on the pages, tears welling in his eyes, which was a daily occurrence, and he talked in a very thick buzzing Z's, rolling R's accent. He said, "Darling, come here, look at this, your name, the name of my people." He was crying. "It is in the bold black and white, the important book, the dictionary. Look here, I'm going to read for you, darling. And you will go to your little school tomorrow. You will ask your little friends, is their name in the dictionary? They will tell you, no, you are the only one. Darling, listen to this. Naiad, it means girl or woman, champion, swimmer." Oh, my God. "God, darling, this is your destiny." So I don't particularly cotton to destiny, but I did become a champion swimmer.
You sure did.
Yeah.
So it started
young, you know.
Well, you do talk about your childhood, and frankly, I appreciate how honest you were about it. And this was a family where, as you describe, Aris, your dad, he was a con artist, seemed like he was always sort of one step ahead of the law.
Yeah.
But also you were dealing with sexual abuse within the family.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't think even my focus wasn't so much the family. It was the coach. You know, I had this coach who believed in me. He thought I was going to be the leader of the world. And to be first molested by him and then continuous coercion, which is almost always the MO of the epidemic, you know, through my high school years, it humiliated me. It rocked my little inner sanctum. It's taken me years and years. Maybe you never get over it. You know, we are a sum of what our experiences. But Marty, I want to keep this in perspective and
sure.
to say that I never have looked at myself as some lone, unfortunate victim out there. What's the new statistic we throw out? One in every four American girls are molested. One in every four, and that's only the ones who talk about it. One in every six boys. So we're talking about an epidemic. As we sit here today in suburban Philadelphia, in urban Philadelphia, this is going on every minute of the day. So I talk about it mainly. In the beginning, when I was younger, I talked about it to take power over it
right.
and speak it out and speak out my anger.
Take control, well, perhaps,
there
of
you
what
go.
Happened.
And,
yeah.
and I'm no longer angry. I don't live it on my skin anymore. But I tell you something, I talk about it now because it is an epidemic, and it's important for us to know. It's important for young people to know that the second they see something coming, they go right away. They go away. They tell somebody, whereas I didn't. I was frightened. I was confused. I was ashamed. So I kept it all inside. I kept it bottled up.
Well, you talk about, and we're almost up in a break here, but you talk about feeling like an injured little girl. Which,
yeah.
And I scribbled that down because I felt like that described what it must have, even as a woman, to feel that injured little girl inside.
Yeah, look at me today. How could I be more grateful? How could I be more humble as to what's coming my way? I got to write this memoir. I travel around speaking and hopefully inspiring people. I'm starting a big movement this year called Ever Walk. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But I have wonderful friends. I'm loved, etc. And still, this every now and then, this little injured girl can grab a cup of coffee out of the microwave and throw it against the kitchen wall and scream out all the misogynist obscenities that coach used on me when I was a little girl. Still in there somewhere. Not much, but somewhere.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about a whole host of things, including Diana Nyad's life as a swimmer, growing up in Florida, becoming a swimmer. And she's written a memoir called Find a Way. We've been spending a lot of time talking about this historic swim that she did a couple of years ago from Cuba to Key West, Florida. Just to recap here, 110.86 miles, 52 hours, 54 minutes, 18 seconds, a historic swim. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, having fun talking with Diana Nyad, both on and off the air. Our little secret there, 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I don't want to belabor the sexual abuse part, but as I said, I think it's important for people to understand it and also to have it out in the open. You do talk about your mother. And your mother saying at some point to you, I was the worst mother in the world.
Yeah.
I think her sense that she knew, because it sounds like you told her about what was going on, and she didn't, stop it, do anything to prevent it, was helpless in her own kind of way.
Those are just the right words. I think it's also part and parcel of the epidemic. Almost everybody, girl or boy, can say, you know, my family members, whoever they went to tell, they're ashamed. They're deeply, first of all, they think it's their fault. They don't want it out in the open. It's disgusting to talk about sexual things. When I would have to tell this to the police and everybody, you have to talk about, you know, where was the penis? How far was it here or there? It's disgusting. And you hate it, especially when the person then is not brought to justice. You know, it's just the whole thing comes around full circle over and over again. So my mother is a French woman. She was very genteel and polite. She said to me, you know, when I was young and told her about all this, she would say, oh, it didn't really happen. You know, it didn't happen that way. You know, please don't embarrass the family. Don't, you know. Now, was I strong enough to then go tell a lawyer or the principal of the school? No, I just felt like I gotta live with this. This is my little cross to bear. You know what? At the same time, though, Marty, honestly, today and even when I was a teenager, I recognized that people had it worse than me. Not necessarily in this arena, but in some arena. People were poor. People were, you know, abused in a much worse way. And actually, many years later, after sitting on psychologist's couch and telling my little story over and over, I met a woman who, in the Holocaust, had been through unspeakable sexual abuse starting at age 3. And I cried my eyes out when she told me this story. She became the SS concubine, sex object at the age of 3, lost her mother and her sister to the gas chambers in that very camp and lived through it. And the woman who adopted her took her in the backyard when she arrived there at age 6 after the Allies rescued them. And she said, "Listen, I can't be your mother. I can't replace your mother, but I'm going to try to help you have a meaningful, loving life. I think it's important for you to tell me what happened." She had no idea the story she was about to hear. So she heard this whole everyday sexual, things that this girl had to do. And she said, "Listen, you're not going to believe me, but the world, people are mostly good, loving people, and you're going to live a good, loving life. So today, you're going to take that story that happened to you, and you're going to put it in the darkest corner of your soul. You can't forget it. You never will. It's too horrific. But don't live it on your skin. Don't live it, because you're going to wake tomorrow in this house and embrace this beautiful life." And that day, you know, I can honestly say that was the day of my biggest healing. I stopped living that story of mine on my skin. I thought, this is a great life. I'm not going to let that guy ruin my life.
Do you think swimming, though, and even the kind of long-distance swimming that you do, which has to be so much about discipline and control, was that one way for you to deal with the sexual abuse, which was to sort of pour all your energy into having a goal like that?
I do, and I think I worked out a lot of anger, a lot of steam, went out in there. But, and I used to be angrier. And not every day. Sometimes I'd be charming like the mayor of New York City when I lived there all those years. And other days, I'd mow you down. If you were coming my way on the sidewalk, men especially, I'd just take an elbow and literally knock them off the curb. And I'm not like that anymore. I've grown up. I'm more loving. Maybe I've been loved, which has made a big difference. But I think out in the ocean, I used to work out that anger, but it wasn't there this time around. As you say, it's a tough sport and there is suffering, but this time around, I don't live it on my skin anymore.
I hear you.
So this time I was often in a state of joy.
You came out, you were about 21, something like this. So this would have been the late 60s?
I was 21, would be 1971. Right after.
And one of the things you say in this book is that it just set you free. I mean, all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but you said, "This is who I am."
Yeah, well, it was a different era.
Probably a lot of things.
It was a different era. I mean, I think that, we can all look back. If you're my age, 66, you can look back and, gay sexuality wasn't out there. In my high school, nobody was gay. Of course they were, but they either didn't know it or didn't act it out. And now we're just like, just about every kid in high school has their choices and it's no big deal. I love this generation. They're the ones, really, it's the millennials who pushed over, gay marriage into acceptance. Like, they're like, who cares? People love each other. Isn't that a good thing? So that certainly wasn't the case. I knew no gay people, men, women, boys, girls, none. So 21, I went to a party. Women, girls were dancing with each other. I was dancing with a bunch of women. I thought, this feels normal. Why didn't I know about this before? But it wasn't a big proclamation. It was never a big political thing for me. It was just kind of just love. Love is a good thing.
You had a date, I think just one date with Woody Allen, right?
Two dates, yeah. He was funny, wonderful. On the second date, he brought a big piece of adhesive tape and he put it over my mouth because he said, you talk the whole time. This time I'm going to get a word in edgewise. He was funny. And then, you go down the route of his personal life and what came of what happened with him and Mia Farrow. And it's none of my business. I don't have judgments about other people, but he was awfully good to me. Even after our two little dates and I told him I was gay, he supported me in the Cuba swim, gave money toward it. And so what can I say? I'm a fan of his films.
You also talk about a woman, Nina Letterman, as you say, love at first sight. This was a woman that you just fell head over heels in love with. It didn't work out. I mean, it lasted for a couple of years, but you are now
10 years.
10 years, yep. Which is a good long time. You are a godparent to her children. She's a friend for life. I mean, I think for a lot of people that just have had their hearts broken, they just cannot imagine that something ending up as wonderful and positive as this.
No, it's true. Nina's, always going to be a cornerstone and important in my life. It didn't happen overnight. I mean, it took me years to not reckon. I guess it was more ego than anything else. I would say, well, surely she's going to recognize how terrific I am. You know, how could you do better than this? She'll be back. She'll be knocking at my door anytime while she was knocking on other doors, and now has been through several relationships and is in a new one and raising a new child.
Yeah.
So, I think always I say to people, you know, you look at a marriage, isn't it part of the metaphor of, you know, if you don't succeed at something in the end, does that mean it was all not worthwhile? Like this Cuba journey, we were failing and failing and failing. And, you know, could I look back at each one and say, that was a waste of time? Why did I ever do it? Because I didn't make it to Florida. No, that journey was exceptional. It was full of nobility, of cause and friendships and adventure. So the same with the marriage. It, right at the moment, it's hard. But later, you have to say, I chose to be with that person for 10 years. Wasn't that a valid way to spend my time for 10 years? Yes, it was, even if it didn't maybe make it to the rocking chair together.
We have a lot of comments here. A tweet from Christophera. How do you choose a weather window? I'm in my 60s. I'm such a slacker. What about cramping? When I spend a long time in the water, I get muscle cramps. Is that something you have to deal with?
You know, I never did. I think that once you're in that kind of shape, you just picture, Chris, I was swimming. You know, one day I'd swim 12 hours. I'd be vomiting on the bathroom floor that night in the fetal position. The next day you swim 13 hours. Then you swim 14 hours. And after a year of that, there's no such thing as muscle cramping anymore. Those muscles are so tuned in and geared in, not to denigrate what you're feeling. But, you know, once you put in the time, you're not going to be cramping.
A question from Kendall. He says, in 2003, Oprah told Diane Nyad that atheists aren't able to experience wonder. If she's comfortable, how does she respond to that? She meaning you.
Well, you know, Oprah did say at the end of our conversation there, she said, oh, so you're an atheist in awe. And she had never heard that. You know, there's a big misconception that atheists are bleak and, you know, the whole world's going to hell in a handbasket. I can stand shoulder to shoulder with any devout Christian, devout Jew, Buddhist, and look at the sunrise and weep just like them at the beauty of this universe, take on the responsibility of living a good life and improving our communities and leaving this world a better place. Mm. I have the same values as the Ten Commandments and the Quran. I just don't believe in the creation of it all. And who cares? Isn't humanity and the responsibility and the love of all of humanity an umbrella ethic over what your individual choices of religion are? That's what makes me crazy about politics. Didn't we work hard, our forefathers and mothers, to make the separation of church and state? You know, it should, you know, your individual faith is yours, and I respect it. I'm not going to argue God with you. If you believe and you pray, beautiful. You know, I respect it. I honor it. It's just not my world. But it doesn't mean that I don't think this life is just as beautiful and my responsibility to it is just as strong as yours. But nobody should put that on us in our schools and, you know, in our government.
Were you ever a person of quote-unquote faith?
I think I was 7, and my father believed in taking us to all. He was a Greek Orthodox, but he believed in exposing us to everything. You'd go to a Jewish synagogue one day, and then you'd go to a Presbyterian church, and we'd go to a Buddhist temple. So it was cool, you know, to learn about world religion. So I went to Sunday school one day, and I came out, and I was sitting in my patent leather shoes, kind of disgruntled in the parking lot. He picked me up, and he said, "What's wrong? You know, what are you mad about something?" I said, "No, they told me this fictional story." I sat there and I listened to God created the trees, and then the next day he created the and then he created, and then on Sunday he was tired, so he took a rest. I said, "Come on, Dad." You know, he said, "No, it's an allegory. It's a beautiful concept." I said, "I don't want to go anymore." So I've never been in church since.
Oh, that's a terrific story. A tweet from Jay. Wasn't at Diane and I had also an Olympian. Does she have any East Block anecdotes from those days? You never made it to the
Olympics. I was not a world-class sprinter by any means. You know, you could call me a national-level swimmer, but my talent was in the ocean. I do, though, as a reporter later with NPR and ABC and Fox, I did know a lot about the Eastern Bloc, you know, issues and the steroid pumping and Shirley Babishoff losing every race she swam in Montreal. All the press called her, you know, Surly Shirley because she was complaining about the East Germans having beard lines, you know, the women. And she was right, and she was proved right. But as she says later, oh, that's great. Everybody sees that I was right 20 years later. I still, when I look at the film, I still finish second in every race. Uh-huh. So who's going to make up for that?
We have a Facebook comment from Samuts who says, who is this dynamo on your show today? Man, I am so inspired. A tweet from Dan. Hey, Radio Times, thanks so much for the incredibly inspirational interview. Just unbelievable.
Thank you.
And an email from Skylar. As an aspiring obstacle race and general athlete, I appreciate Diana's story so much. She inspires me, and the way she talks about the mental aspect of her swim gets so much with the way that my mind works during her own my own races. She's amazing. Thank you. And I thank you as well. It goes on from there. A lot of thank yous and
that's
people
very
appreciating
nice.
What you have to say. As you mentioned, you're going to be doing these walks across parts of the United States.
Yeah. My badass friend Bonnie, who was my head handler on the swims, Bonnie Stoll, she and I have this vision. It's called Everwalk. So we're not up and running yet. We'll have a website soon, everwalk.com. But you know what we're going to do, Marty? We are going to turn America into a culture, a nation of walkers. You are going to, in 10 years, and you're going to be one of them. I'm looking in your eye for the commitment right now.
I'm
sure you are.
I'm in.
We are going to have millions of Americans walking every day. They're going to walk after supper with their families and to school with their kids. And we are going to change the diabetes, the heart disease, the obesity factors in America. So we're going to start long walks. We're going to walk from Philly right here to Washington, D.C. We're going to walk L.A. to San Diego, Boston to New York City. And then eventually, after 5 or 6 years, and everybody's been part of this, and they've been walking all year long to come out and be on the long walks, we're going to walk cross country, and we're going to get a million people to walk cross country. It's going to be awesome.
Well, I imagine it'd be hard to say no to Diana Nyad. You quote, I think it was a doctor or perhaps a researcher saying that sitting is the new smoking, and we all do. Here we are. We all do a lot of sitting.
Yeah. You know, fast food nation has contributed largely, you know, to where we've come and all these diseases, especially affecting our weight and our hearts, et cetera. But we do sit. We're a nation of sitter. We sit all day and then all night. So that's the whole point. Is I'd rather be, you know, start a swimming exodus because that's what I am, a swimmer. But it's not practical, you know. But walking, just about everybody. We're going to have the disabled with us. We're going to have kids with us. Get away from their screens. And we're going to have the baby boomers, clearly, my people. And we're going to walk across this beautiful nation.
Do you have time to swim or do you still swim? Is it still part of your life?
I do.
Is there something... A body of water that you haven't swum that
there
you
isn't,
want to do?
Marty. I mean, you could look. What is the Earth? Is it 4/5 or 7/8 water?
Something like
so
that.
So you could find a lot of bodies of water that are imaginative, that are compelling. But Cuba was it. Cuba was my soul. Yeah. You know, in my 20s, I was a long distance swimmer. So I swam in Italy and Quebec and Argentina and did a lot of wonderful swims, Manhattan, etc. But Cuba was always it was bigger than a swim. It was like the emblem of living large, doing something probably impossible. And it would take every ounce of the fabric of your potential to try it even. And so there's nothing else that touches me like that. I have to live large like that out of the water now.
Interesting. And it was when you were a little girl, your mother said to you, oh, you can see Cuba. You can almost swim there,
you know,
right?
She did. She pointed out, you know, in her French accent, you know, I said, where is it, Mom? Where's Cuba? We were all filled with the mystique of Cuba. We were in Florida right after the revolution. And she said, look, it's this way. No, lift your arm up this way, there. It's right there. As a matter of fact, darling, it's so close. You little swimmer, you could almost swim there. So that was the beginning. There was a little buzzing of the imagination of, really? Do you think so? And I talked to my mom, who wasn't with us anymore at the swim. I stood at the shore and I said, Mom, you know what? Somebody actually did swim there.
I'm sure she'd be proud. Diane Anaya, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. What
thank
a hoot.
Thank you. Thank you. You are a hoot as well.
And her book, her memoir, is called Find a Way. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program, and we've probably posted some pictures on our Facebook page and tweeted them out as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.